Hello, everybody. I am so excited to be talking to my guest, Frank Adlington Stringer. And Frank is standing politically for the Green Party. Now, this is something I've thought about numerous times, and I don't think I've got a thick enough skin. So I have nothing but admiration for anybody who stands for public office. Frank, how are you? Where are you?
I'm really well, thank you, Mark. I'm in Wingerworth, which is a little village just outside of Chesterfield. And as you say, I'm standing for Mayor of the East Midlands this time round, but I'm already elected councillor here as well. So I've been in the game for a little while now, and so maybe my skin is a little bit thicker than it once was.
It's a changed business, right? So, you know, back in the day, when I first started in local government, there was no such thing as email. There was no such thing as Twitter. There was no such thing as Facebook. I mean, it feels odd to think back to those times. But if you wanted to talk to a member or to a politician, you actually had to write to them, or you had to go and wait in queue at surgeries. Everything's changed, but we'll get on to that. So, Frank, I ask the same three questions of all my guests. What did your childhood, or did it taste like? What did it sound like? And what did it smell of?
Okay. My childhood, it sounded like, and I can tell you the sound because I can hear it now, the sound of birdsong, that's for sure. So where I live is beautiful rural Derbyshire, and I have many memories of being outside, being muddy, being dirty, being naughty, and really enjoying everything that our world has to offer. And that's definitely the sound that I associate with my childhood.
I love that. Muddy, dirty, and naughty. Muddy, dirty, and naughty. I love that.
It was very much, you know, naked kid running around just enjoying the world. That was it in the back garden. And I loved that completely.
How old are you, Frank?
I'm 26.
26. So you're the same age as my middle daughter, my third child. And they actually formed the Naked Gang when they were younger. And that was for the express purposes of running around naked in the garden. That's essentially what they did. And this was in Saltaire. So it was a terrace. They were just permanently running around. My kids were naked. I don't think you see that often these days. So I love that. Birdsong, muddy, dirty, naughty. What's next?
What's next? What did my childhood taste like? I think what I would say to that is fish. And that's probably a bizarre thing to say. My dad loves his cooking and would always make sure that he introduced us to everything we could. And there are photos of us as youngsters with eating all kinds of bizarre and wonderful things. And I'm a vegan now, but I always just have that fond memory of being encouraged to try. And fish was a big part of what we used to eat and the life I used to have. So yeah, that's definitely the taste I remember of my childhood.
That's amazing that is. And so you've got taste and you've got sound there.
Smell of. That's probably a bit of a harder one to answer. Some of the smells I associate with my childhood. I remember the smell of my granddad completely. He always used to smell like lavender. He had this aftershave that he would put on that he got specially. Other smells I associate. I don't know. I could probably think of some smells that came along with being muddy and naughty outside as well.
I think you've hit the nail on the head straight off. Tell me about your granddad.
My granddad was the most gentle human being I've ever met. And in many ways, he's one of my inspirations for what I do now. He was a house builder. That was the family business. And he built the house that I live in, the house I'm in right now. And his whole approach was community. So he has, well, there are countless things he's done. And when I represent the ward now as a councillor that he lived in his whole life, where he built a large part of the houses. And I will knock doors to this day and people will say to me, oh, I know your granddad and he built my house and how generous he was. And the doctor, the local doctor who came from India and couldn't afford to build her surgery, he helped her to do that. And, you know, I'm really proud of his community values and the things he did. But he was just always such a gentle, loving and funny person to be around. He would despair seeing me in politics now, and you know, luckily he got to see me involved a little bit at the start, but he wouldn't have time for the politicians I have to spend my time with. He wouldn't be able to do it, and he'd just rather have a good time and try and help people. And I think that's what approach I take to politics as well. It's kind of like trying to help people and be community based. And yeah, he's definitely with me in that approach, I think.
It's really interesting, isn't it? Because that, you know, when we think back to politics and we think back to how it started, it was about organization. It was about lifting people higher. And it feels like we've lost literally all of that in politics now. When you look, I mean, I take it your granddad's no longer with us, the way you were talking about that.
He's not. Yeah, we lost him about 2 years ago.
Okay, I'm sorry about that. It's funny, isn't it, with grandparents? They hold our hands for a really short period, relatively, but they hold our hearts forever. It's a very special relationship. When you look at politics now, what do you see as the inherent problems within it? And then ultimately, how do you think we can fix it?
Absolutely. I mean, politics is broken, and I think everyone in the country kind of agrees on that at the moment. The way forward is probably the harder bit to figure out. For me, I think that our voting system is a huge part of the problem. Mm-hmm. It forces us to choose between red or blue, the lesser of two evils for most people, and it doesn't allow for nuanced discussion or debate. And I think that has to change, and it also probably has a huge impact on the media as well, and the way the media report or the way that the media present certain issues, sort of a binary, a yes or no, and I don't think that that works. I think going beyond that as well is education. For me, coming out of school, politics wasn't something I was massively engaged with, and it was only through life that I started to realise that things in society weren't working and picking up problems and asking questions. But I think it's a failure of our education system that we don't teach people how to vote, why they should vote, who they can vote for, and, well, even going beyond that, about how you pay your taxes, how a mortgage works, all of these sort of things. But I think that if people had a better understanding of how the political system works, that would be a really good place to start.
Yeah, you've hit the nail on the head. And I did a workshop recently, and there were lots of young people. It was an all-dayer at Nottingham Trent. Loads of young people there. It's all about how creativity is the answer to the world, many of the world's problems. And you've got to be really careful that you don't get dragged down like a single issue, but really important area like, you know, packaging and plastic, which is really important. We have to broaden it. That's not going to solve things. And I asked the audience who were kind of, I guess, 16 to 21. I said, you know, how many of you are going to vote? It's a big year. How many are you going to vote? And no one put their hand up. And I said, why? And they said, well, boring, doesn't impact me in my life. And we just heard a talk about a young man who had significant issues with addiction, mental health challenges, and had been lifted up and helped out by a whole system that was there for that purpose. And I said, do you think that's politics? And they went, no, that's not politics. And I said, that's politics. That's how we organize and set the systems up. And it determines whether people fall through the cracks or not. And that was a difficult conversation. But then this guy at the front, who was like a business person, he put his hand up. He went, look, I'm 42 and I can't tell the difference between Labour and the Conservatives, Liberal Dems and the Greens. And I'm thinking, how can you get to 42 and not know the difference? And this isn't their fault. This is our fault. We have failed to make politics compelling. So it's really interesting. So if we think of politics as needing fixing, that's one thing, that's a system. And obviously there's a thing about proportional representation and a need to change the system and get people active. We can talk about that in a bit more detail in a minute. Whilst we can see faults with politics, representation, proportional representation, engagement, all of those things need work, you know. It's not enough to sign a change now petition. You've got to go and do something. That's really interesting, and we'll come back to that. But when we look at the way that we live, the way that the UK has been governed over the last, I'm just going to go back 50 years, what issues are we missing? How have we got to the position that we're in at the moment? And how do we make for a fairer, more equitable and more regenerative society?
Well, that's a huge question, and one that we should all be working really hard to find an answer to. You said before that you think that creativity is the answer to most problems, if not all problems. And I would be inclined to agree with you. I'm a creative at heart. I wanted to go study television and radio production before I realised that the world was in a dire state and needed fixing. And I started off by writing letters to my Member of Parliament, trying to lobby, trying to protest, setting up groups. And I got to a point where I thought, well, I'm trying to convince the wrong people to do the right thing. And instead, I went and studied politics. And that isn't something that came naturally to me, but I thought, I've got to force myself into this because people like me, creatives, are so often left out of these discussions, and our different perspectives, our different ways of thinking are so desperately needed. We need a fresh approach. And so I think that the answer, it lies amongst us. It's within our communities. It's getting different people to the table, making sure that we are heard and listened to. And so coming back to the election only very briefly, as mayor, I'm committed to setting up citizens' assemblies because I think that any one elected representative of any political party does not have all the answers. And if they claim to, then you should not vote for them. Someone who says that they are prepared to listen and learn is exactly the kind of representative we need. Someone who's trying to find solutions, offering leadership, but wanting to bring in different voices and have a collaborative approach. I think that is the key to solving the mess we're in, rather than pinning our hopes on someone who is trying to be perfect and getting us stuck in a media cycle about who's right or wrong, because ultimately we're all right sometimes and we're all wrong in the rest of the time.
No, I get that completely. It's interesting because we look at politics societally, we look at politicians for the answers, for leadership, and what you're saying, and I completely agree with you, is we need to flip this. We need to look at politicians for creativity, community and conversation, all the C's. There's two-way flow to get into politics and begin learning. God, that's a lovely way of looking at it. And you know, I find it absolutely fascinating when we look at levels of disengagement, and it's all geared around a system that is patriarchal, a system that is top down, a system that is not fit for the future, and yet we keep using the system expecting a different answer. If we were to redesign it from the bottom up, citizens' assemblies included, what would you build in?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much there. I think we've got to get away from this idea of you vote for someone and expect them to make all the right decisions for you for 4 years. I wouldn't trust anyone to make the right decisions for me every day for 4 years. And so I think there needs to be much more opportunity to feed into that system. I think that we, on a larger scale here, talking properly of national politics, is trying to reform the House of Lords, if not abolish it, looking at the monarchy as well and the role that they play in our country, really trying to bring politics back down to the grassroots level, giving power to people in our communities to be able to manage them in the way that suits us best, because nobody else can tell us what we need.
I get that completely. Given the fact we need to reimagine this, and given the fact one of the same two parties wins each time, and it's in neither of their interests, once they're in power, to change it, how on earth do we create a coalition? And these are hard words to use in politics these days. How do we create a coalition for change? And how do we ensure that the bits that you're engaged in within the Green Party, I mean, Caroline Lucas has done an incredible job single-handedly. She must be exhausted. And if you look at the proportion of the population wanting to vote Green and the proportion of MPs, it's miles and miles apart. How do we engage? And it's going to be Labour that wins the next election. But how do we engage Labour to become a greener red? How do we do that?
I think I talked about people that inspired me earlier and talked about my granddad. Well, let's talk about the opposite end of the spectrum. Nigel Farage is someone I take political inspiration from. I don't say that lightly. But what that man has been able to do is make the biggest impact on the British political system in the last decade and without ever winning an election. And that's incredible. And Reform are doing the same again at this election. They're almost controlling the narrative by threatening to stand in every seat, by threatening to take votes away from the Conservative Party. And the likelihood is Reform won't elect a Member of Parliament at this election, but they've managed to stoke fear in the Conservative Party. And I don't agree with a lot of the ways that they go about doing that. I certainly don't agree with their belief system. But I think we on the left have to sort of take some lessons from what they are doing and apply it to our politics. And the Labour Party are very complacent at the moment. They know they're going to walk into power at the next general election. And we are kind of allowing that to happen because we want better. And there are certainly people out there who think, I'd love to vote for the Green Party, but I'm going to vote Labour because we have to get rid of the Tories. And that highlights the problem that we have in our electoral system. But also by doing that, we are letting Labour off the hook, and we are allowing them to scrap their £28 billion Green pledge and still take our votes for granted. And so, well, the amount of people who have spoken to me during this election campaign and said, I would vote for you, but we need to get Labour in. I don't want to split the vote. And if all of those people voted for us, not only would we probably get elected in the first place, but even if we didn't and we took enough votes from the Labour Party, at the next election, you can guarantee that Labour would offer something that was greener, fairer and better for our communities. And so it's about voting for what you actually believe in and demanding better. Don't settle for business as usual. Don't accept the status quo. If you really, truly want change, you have to vote for it. You have to vote for what you believe in. And even if you don't win at the first election or the second election, eventually, with time, as our movement grows stronger and stronger, we will get there. And I've always said, I don't care who enacts these policies. I don't care who gets the credit, who gets the fame. As long as it gets done and we solve the climate crisis and we put our communities first, then I'm happy. So whether we are an enormous pressure group or we do elect an entire Green government, as long as this happens, it has to happen. But that only happens by voting Green.
Yeah, it's really tricky. So my constituency used to be Shipley in Yorkshire, in just north of Bradford. The MP was a guy called Chris Leslie, who I think went to work in East Nottinghamshire, actually, in the end. He's then span off to form a kind of left-wing splinter party, which collapsed. But he took over from Marcus Fox, who was the original chairman, or not the original, but one of the chairman of the 1922 committee, and then lost his seat after 8 years because the Green Party performed so well. It did exactly what you just said. It split the vote, and they've had a Tory in, a guy called Philip Davis, since, I guess that would be 2000 and, I don't know, five, something like that. No, I can't remember. Yeah, I can't remember when that election was. Since then. So I'm with you, right? But I can completely understand why people don't do what you've said, because Philip Davis is the warning, right? You open the door and you let an ultra-right Tory in, and you, then you can't get rid of them because there's still that split. So with that in mind, and this is what really interests me, with that in mind, how can you come closer? How can you work smarter so that that doesn't happen, and green policies? Because that's what's missing in all of this. That's what we'll come on to that in a second. How do we do this in a system that doesn't work for us, it works against us?
Yeah, it is one of the awful downsides of this, right? That there is a possibility of letting in bad politicians. But if Labour can't beat us, Labour being an enormous party machine who have enormous amounts of funding from trade unions, from private interests, if they can't beat the Green Party, which is a people power campaign, I'm running a campaign based on a crowdfunder. And if they can't beat us, that they don't deserve to have office. And so I think that they have the responsibility for that. If there is a right-wing politician that comes in as a result of us splitting the vote, then that's Labour's fault. That isn't our fault. It isn't the fault of those people who voted for something better. It's the fault of the opposition party for not being a good enough opposition. So I don't take responsibility for that.
I love that response. It's really interesting, you know. We're trying to create a perfect or a better government in an imperfect system. And this makes life incredibly difficult. So we may come back to this right at the end. But let's talk about sustainability. I mean, I'm 33 years into my career. I'm 56 this year, coming this in September. And I've been working in sustainability since 1990. In 1989, the Green Party won 16% of the vote in the European elections. That is astonishing. I thought that was the wave that was going to take us all the way through. And it sadly then kind of damped down a little bit. What do we focus on in terms of sustainability when it comes to the broader policies of governance? How do sustainability and economics come together? How do sustainability and healthcare come together? And I've got some answers here, obviously. How does sustainability and social services come together? How do we make the public realise that this is not a single strand issue? It's a much bigger thing than that.
Yeah, it's really important. I think that's why the Green Party has this joined up approach, a holistic view. The mayoral position that I'm standing for has various pots of funding. And one of those pots is an £18 million fund for net zero ambitions. I've said, if I'm mayor, forget that. All £4 billion of our spending will be on the environment. Now, that doesn't mean we're going to spend all of the mayoral budget planting trees. That means when we spend money for transport, we're spending it on transport systems that are sustainable. When we're building homes, we're building sustainable homes. When we're creating energy, it's green energy. And that's what we have to do. And when we look at the economy, for example, it's about changing the way we measure success. So we're not just measuring profit and growth, an endless number that we can chase and chase and chase, because everyone can always earn a penny extra. Instead, it's measuring well-being and happiness. And if you have a population which is well educated, which is happy, which is enjoying their life, they have good standards of well-being, physical and mental health, then you are doing the right thing. You are doing well. Looking at the amount of profit made in the country doesn't give you a true reflection of that. So it's about changing the way we understand and measure success, and then ensuring that everything we do has an interconnected, joined up plan. It's looking at things together collectively, rather than having silos of funding and saying, okay, we're going to do this for education, this for housing, and this is the little bit that we'll spend on some nice green things on the edges, some little pretty flowers. We've got to get beyond that and realise everything is interconnected.
Absolutely. I mean, my entire career has been based on placing sustainability at the heart of the innovation process rather than in the marketing process. And that's, we can make that from a small business into a government. It's exactly the same thing. It's been piecemeal and tokenistic. And what Labour have announced recently on cutting back their net zero ambitions, the whole debate over ULEZ at the by-elections, it's embarrassing. The word eco sits in economy as strongly as it sits in ecology. And it comes from the Greek word oikos. And it just means home. An economy is keeping our house in order, and ecology is keeping our house in order. That's what it means. And they were the same thing. And at some point, they were cleaved apart and placed in opposition to each other. And it's a falsism. It's not true. If we can build a sustainable economy, then we will build a less impactful economy and create a green jobs revolution like nothing we've ever seen before. Every plumber in the UK now, every plumber in the East Midlands now, needs to be retraining to be able to fit underfloor heating, air source heat pumps, ground source heat pumps, making those things work in conjunction with solar voltaics and also solar hot. There's no shortage of work and innovation. There's just a shortage of ambition. And that's what we need to solve.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't have said it better myself. We have the potential. We have people who are willing. It just takes political will, and that's what we're lacking.
It's exactly that. And I think that the old narratives, you know, it's really hard to break the old narratives of, well, you can either be green or you can be successful. Oh,
yeah.
Even if we go to, like, you know, the Tories always take care of the economy, and in this case, it's always worse under Labour. It isn't. It's demonstrably not true. None of that. Both of those arguments are not true. And yet, the media recites them like parrots and makes it bite-sized. How does sustainability and how do the Green Party, how do you tackle populism, and where do we begin to see a turning tide of utter rubbish and misinformation?
Yeah, I think we've had that over the last, well, the 2016 was an awful year for populism and for this headline gossip that was running our political system. And I think we're sort of getting away from that. maybe I'm in an echo chamber, I don't know, but I think people do want something refreshing and honest, and they are fed up with being missold things through marketing techniques. I mean, Take Back Control was an advertising campaign, not a political campaign, and it was all about using snappy slogans to trick people into voting for what politicians wanted. We have to change so much about what we do. It's about education, so that people have the tools needed to challenge lies and misinformation when politicians spout it. It's about ensuring that our media is fair, ensuring that the BBC, Channel 4, aren't attacked by government, but are given funding that they need to be able to provide decent journalism. It's about engaging with people and listening to people and respecting voters, not taking them for granted, but ensuring that voters are respected and their concerns are highlighted and listened to. It's awful, the state we're in, but I don't think it will take too much hard work to get back from that. The only problem is, well, and I've seen there's so many barriers to standing in an election, right? It's cost me £10,000 to get my name on the ballot paper and in a supposedly democratic election booklet. If you can't pay for it, you don't get included in the booklet. You don't get sent around to the households. That's terrible. So we have to change the way the electoral system works to make sure that everyone has an opportunity to stand, that everyone's voices can be heard. And, well, again, I'm an elected councillor. I get £600 a month. I put my payslips online so people can see what money I earn. People think politicians are loaded. Those at the top are, but people working for their communities are not given a penny. And we are doing it because we really care. And so it upsets me sometimes when people will say, I vote at the general election, but I don't bother voting locally. And you think that's where you have people, honest people who are really working hard for you. And they're really important that you select those representatives well. So there's so much we have to change. But it comes through education, it comes through engaging people. And I hope that I don't want to call it a career in politics because I'm just someone who's standing up and trying to make a bit of a difference. But throughout my time in elected office, I hope that I represent people honestly and fairly and put my hands up when I make a mistake. I think that's really crucial as well. And give people a sense of trust again.
That's what's missing, isn't it? I mean, you've using numbers, you've drawn attention to the real problem here. You don't go into politics unless you're already wealthy.
Yeah.
You don't go and put into politics unless you think you can become wealthier. And you know, right now we don't have a government. We've got the receivers in and they are asset stripping. And this is utterly terrible. And the rollback on green policies, I mean, this is not a game. Right, we're at 1.63 degrees above pre-industrial average temperatures. The sea has risen nearly 2 degrees. We're about to see huge acidification of the oceans that will dissolve coral reefs and therefore the bottom of the food chain for many species. Like, this isn't about a nicer summer. This is about a worse climate. And I would love to share your view that we have reached peak populism. I don't think we've even begun this. You watch any post on Facebook about EVs or solar power and you just watch the trolls. They're everywhere. My fear is not that we can't fix the climate challenge. My fear is that we can't fix the truth and trust challenge. That's the biggest thing that I see that we've got to defeat. And having politicians like you, having honest, very open, clear, authentic people like you. We need more of this, but I wouldn't stand. I just wouldn't stand.
And that's why?
I think two reasons. I think I'm too thin-skinned, too easily offended, which is where I started this conversation. And secondly, I need to earn money. You know, I need to raise a family. And people think politicians get loads. We all know the issue with expenses, right? The whole issue with when we look at a national government during the Thatcher years, and I can't blame her for everything, just most things. During the Thatcher years, she said, right, we're not giving any more pay rises, which is what should have happened. Politicians need to be paid ridiculously well, right? We're not going to give you any more pay rises. We're going to freeze pay, but we're going to give you unlimited expenses. So there was an official agreement to push expenses up and turn a blind eye to what they were and keep salaries at an acceptable level. They weren't acceptable. So that's why we're in this position. And that's why, you know, when you talk about duck houses and you talk about a misspending, people get really angry. I would too. We just need to pay people really well, you know. And having worked in local government and having worked with incredible members and incredible politicians, and actually from different sides of the political spectrum,
yeah, of course,
I just think people need to be rewarded effectively. This isn't a hobby, you know, you do when you retire. If that's how we get into more trouble. This is the future of our kids, the future of our businesses. You know, whilst business has created most of the world's problems, it's the only thing that can fix them. And we just need a different model. We need a completely different model. So when it comes to your mayoral ambitions, which you'll be getting my vote, there's no two ways about that. When it comes to that, and this is a horrible question, and I've not warned you, in the first 100 days, what are you going to do? In the first, maybe the first year, what are you going to do? How are you going to change things?
Absolutely. So there's a lot to do because this is a brand new position just being created. So there's going to be a lot of work about getting the system set up, a new authority set up, but that's really important work as well. So we talked briefly on citizens' assemblies. It's about setting up an authority which listens to people. The way it's been built as well means that some of the local councils have been left out, and I think that they should be given a voice and given a way to input. It's about building a really good culture, making sure that we are looking after our people, making sure that we are leading the way, doing things differently. Whether we look at doing things like four-day working weeks and trying to make sure we've got a really inclusive workplace. So those are kind of the boring things that we'll be getting to work with and we have to do as part of this transition period as the authority sets up. But then on a more exciting level, there'll be things like bringing buses back into public control. I think it's really important that we do that. Democratic oversight. So if you elect a politician and then complain to them about your buses, they can just go and have a conversation with the private bus company, just like you can, essentially. And if the private bus company don't want to do anything about it, then they won't. It's important we have control, so when you have a complaint, we can fix it for you. So bring the buses back into control. Another thing, which is a little bit of a more fun thing, is a regional festival. So we want to explore ways of celebrating our past, because what I'm offering is a green industrial revolution. So looking backwards, all we've achieved, renovating a lot of our lost spaces, reopening some of our lost spaces. We're looking at doing something with Belper Mills, which has been left for absolute ruin. But going around the region, introducing myself as a new mayor and using that as an opportunity to celebrate our wonderful communities, all the diversity we have in our people and in our business, and making sure that we really celebrate ourselves, give ourselves the credit we deserve as we look forward to this next chapter, what we can do now we have a mayor, what we can do as we take on this challenge of a green industrial revolution. And so there is a whole load of work that needs to be done. It won't be easy, but it will be transformational change that we're making. Doing a land spatial plan, again, sounds very boring, very dry, but this is a first opportunity to link up our region, look at the spaces we want to rewild. How do we link up active travel across the region? These are the really important things that we need to be doing so that we can get on as a region. We've had the lowest levels of public investment last year, and we're five times bigger than the West Midlands. We've been ignored, and now's the time to put ourselves on the map, say, here we are, this is what we want to do, this is the plan, and I'll go to government and demand reparations for the 15 years of austerity, say it's not being good enough, this is the funding we need, this is how we need to invest, these are the plans I've got to do it, and long term, if we invest now, these are all the benefits we will get out of that. We will get benefits because we've invested in our adult education. We're giving people an opportunity to be able to switch to sustainable work. We're giving green grants to our manufacturers to make sure that they can be producing things sustainably. There's so much we can do now to benefit the future. And when you go to government and you sell them that, then they will give the funding that we need. But for too long, we've not had a leader who's been ambitious enough to do that, who's not been bold enough to make those requests. But hopefully, on the 2nd of May, we'll have a green mayor and we'll be able to go to government and get on with some of this work.
Yes, please. Right. And you're right. I love the way your bravery and your verbiage, Frank, is so beautifully positioned. I'm from the East Midlands, right? And the West Midlands I love as well. I don't have any preference. It's just Mercia to me. But I love the fact that that we have, you know, Leicester made, Hinckley made the best wool textiles in the country because of its grazing. Leicester understood more about making fabric than anyone else. Nottingham only made lace because it made great stockings, and it only stopped making stockings for men when trousers became fashionable, and it had to innovate. It had to use that kit to make something else. Then we've got all of the heavy industry as we move towards Sheffield, Chesterfield. Sheffield was part of the Midlands for a long, long time, right? So, and then we've got the resources that are under the ground. We've got the, I'm in the old coal mining area of Northwest Leicestershire. My pit out the back, literally the other side of this wall, has the record for the most coal taken out of the ground from any pit in any one day in the UK. We made this region from the ground, and we forget that. Now, all of those things have environmental impacts, but we can remake this region now. The coalfield sites around here are now covered in solar panels. We're manufacturing products from local wool, and that has a much lower environmental impact than importing merino from New Zealand. There are so many opportunities to reimagine the role of a region that you would normally just drive through. And I'm fiercely proud of what we are and what we've done. And to reframe the future in terms of sustainability, that has to be the way that we go forwards. And fewer roads would be nice as well. And that's
fewer roads would be nice.
Better trains would be lovely. All of those things. What's your biggest challenge, do you think?
Well, we've overcome, I would say, the election's one challenge. We've overcome the £10,000 entry fee. We're doing well in the election, and we're genuinely excited to see what happens. But once we do have a Green Mayor, the biggest challenge will be bringing people together. And that will be the biggest challenge for whoever's mayor. I think perhaps as a Green Mayor, I'll be best placed to offer some sort of negotiation and compromise ability that the others don't possess. Because the way that it's set up, we've got, we're going to have over two unitary authorities that are Labour and two unitary authorities that are Conservative. So I'm kind of worried if we get a mayor who's red or blue, because they might just pander to the councils that are their colour and direct funding in that way. So it will be to have an independent mayor, someone who's not told by London what to say, someone who isn't being pressured by government to enact certain policies, will be able to actually listen to our region. But making sure that we're all singing from the same hymn sheet, that we all see this vision, is going to be the biggest challenge. To go to the Conservatives locally, to go to Labour locally and say, right, these are our plans. This is how we sell this. This is what the public want. That's the biggest challenge. But like I've said, this is why citizens' assemblies are so important, because if we can get buy-in from the public and the public say, yes, we want this, then there is no way that our councils, whatever colour they might be, can reject that, because that's the will of the people. And so that's why we have to deliver this change in that way. But it will be ridiculous to say there aren't huge challenges. This is a setup, this is a brand new authority. It's going to take a huge amount of work to get it up and running, but it needs someone with enthusiasm, someone with energy, someone who's got a vision. And I would like to think that that's myself. And hearing you talk about our region, how proud you are about it, gets me excited. Because I am immensely proud of what we've achieved. If we hadn't had Arkwright's Mill in Cromford, the rest of the world wouldn't be as it is now. Elon Musk would not have Silicon Valley. We created the modern world, and we should be proud to now try and create a better, different kind of modern world. We want to be there again, leading the way, be a powerhouse once more.
Totally. And we can argue, Manchester would argue with us, I'm going to say now, right? But the Midlands created the Industrial Revolution. There's no two ways about that. Now it needs to create an industrial revolution. And it will, right? It will. We still make the finest textiles. We still make the best bicycles. We still, you know, arguably could make the best motor vehicles if that's the thing that you want to do. I'm so excited for where we are, where we're sat geographically. I'm so excited for where we're sat ecologically. It could be really easy to be depressed on where we are now, but we've democratized the ability to build businesses that build back better. God, that sounds like a Tory phrase, that build a sustainable future. And we've never had this before. This is such an exciting time to be alive. The thing that's missing, the thing that you sold, Frank, is leadership. We've never had effective green focused leadership. And I heartily hope that people will look at local elections in a different way and say, okay, let's start building from the ground up. If we may not change Westminster, we may not change the House of Lords. By gosh, it needs changing. We may not be able to do that, but let's change Worksop. Let's change Nottingham. Let's change Chesterfield, Hinckley, Leicester and Northampton. Let's change Derby. If we can start there, we can only go one way. That's the way that I look at this. Grassroots people who really give a shit, whose granddads injected a sense of purpose, place and dynamism. That's what's going to change this country. Not massive hedge fund backed individuals who are just parachuted in to get a bit of kudos.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Mark. I completely agree. That's the change we have to have. We have to start thinking locally and then working our way up to the bigger world. And we have to have hope. And I'm a creative and I've forced myself into this world of politics. But I do think that politics is inherently creative. It's all about imagination. It's about creating or envisaging a world that doesn't yet exist and trying to bring that to fruition. And I think that's something that's so exciting. And that should galvanise our young people, our business owners, to really want to be a part of that. It's not enough to be just upset about potholes. We need to make those repairs, but we can do so much better than that.
You're absolutely right. I mean, I'm angry about potholes because they disrupt my cycle to and from the station. Yeah. However, there are way bigger fish to fry. And I think we've forgotten that we've got the power to make the change. Yes. And we need to remind our citizens, our people, we're not consumers, we're citizens. And you don't have to use shopping as a form of antidepressant. You can use shopping as a form of change. And this is where we've been bamboozled and placated by, you know, larger businesses and government in equal measure. Our money is our most powerful thing, and our second most powerful thing is our vote. And you've got to use it well. Frank, to meet someone like you, who is young, dynamic, who is not naive, who is completely aware of the challenges that they face, is a breath of fresh air. I've already said you've got my vote. If there's anything I can do in terms of local or regional campaigning, please let me know. Just to finish off, one last question. Creativity is nothing other than imagining a world that hasn't arrived yet. It's part of what I do in my job. And you used almost exactly the same phrase a few minutes ago. How can we explain to the public that they can be happier, healthier, and wealthier with less impact? How do we draw a picture of a greener, fairer, more regenerative society without making people feel that they'll be more financially worse off?
Yeah, that's about getting around the rhetoric that's out there at the moment, because we talked about ULEZ and the toxic language that's used by the other parties around that. And we have to escape that, because retrofitting your home and giving you renewable energy will bring your bills down. And a lot of the changes that we want to see will make life more affordable for people, put more money in people's pockets and empower us to do more. And so it's a myth, and we have to be proud as Greens to talk about business, to talk about the economy, to not feel scared about those things, but to realise that we have a plan, we have a different way of doing things, and that we can stand up and talk to those people. And throughout this campaign, I've met with business owners from across the region, and they are the kind of forums that perhaps Greens would traditionally shy away from and not think we can speak to. But we're more than just tree huggers. We're here to think creatively about all of the systems that we have. And so it's about engaging and putting ourselves into those shoes and having sensible conversations with the right kind of people and talking honestly with voters and showing it can happen. We start locally and we prove that it can happen. There's a quote, I think William Gibson, who said that the future is already here, it's just not very evenly distributed. And I think that is really important, that we realise that we have the potential and the creativity. We've just not unlocked it yet. And people are working to do this. We just have to bring it together and unleash it and allow everyone to have a piece of that pie and to see how much better life can be if we work together.
Absolutely. I mean, hear, hear. And I think, you know, I've been doing sustainability. I've been working in sustainability for 34 years, actually, now, and I've failed. Right? We've failed. What we've tried to do is scare people into action by telling them how shit the world's going to be and how much less fun they can have, rather than by drawing a picture of how much better the world could be and how much freer and fairer it is. The carrot is way more appealing than the stick. And that's the way green politics has got to go. And I feel that it's in safe hands with you, Frank. I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join me this morning, but also for standing up, being counted, being seen. If you stand for nothing, you fall for anything. And I'm really glad you're leaving.
Thank you ever so much, Mark. I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with me. It's been good fun this morning.
Ace, thank you.